On every front, the armies of the United Nations are on the march. NBC reporters are standing by to bring you the latest invasion bulletins. Stay tuned to WEIF, New York. Don Hollenbeck follows in just a moment.
This is Don Hollenbeck in the NBC newsroom in New York. It's now just over 24 hours since Allied troops hit the beach in France, and still the reports of our progress, actual reports of miles gained, definite localities where fighting is going on, continue to come mainly from the enemy. General Eisenhower's headquarters have issued two communiques. Both say things are going well, casualties have been very light. Allied leaders from President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill on down have expressed their satisfaction. And a Navy man just back in London from the beach says all the main points have been gained. The general situation seems to be that the Allied forces have cleared the beaches of a 60-mile stretch of Normandy of enemy troops. Armor-backed landing parties are ranging inland early Wednesday. It's almost full daylight at the scene at this moment. And reinforcements are streaming across the channel, not hindered by a rough sea and a bad wind. Reports reached London that the Paris-Cherbourg railway line had been cut at Caen. That railway is the main line supplying German forces in the Cherbourg Peninsula. The German high command, however, insists that no Allied troops have got into Caen, and this contradicts Prime Minister Churchill's assertion today that Allied troops were fighting in this railway city. RAF pilots have been coming back with good news all night. One of them said, "We could tell the beaches were secure. We could see our soldiers standing up." And to me, who spent some time prone at Salerno, to anyone who was on that beach, that means a lot. We now know that the first ground forces to land on the French beaches just 24 hours ago were Americans. They went ashore at 6:30 a.m., followed by Canadians and British an hour later. Combined British and American paratroopers shared the honors of being the first soldiers of the liberating armies to set foot on French soil. They had battled the Germans for several hours before the main landings. In the first dispatch received tonight from the soil of France, it was reported that the Canadian invasion force won its beachhead and moved inland after just 2 hours and 45 minutes of fighting, which must have been savage. The Canadians have well and truly wiped out the bitter memory of Dieppe. Penetrations as deep as 13 miles into France have been reported, and the German radios have been buzzing with reports of Allied landings at a dozen points, with the latest and most important on both sides of the estuary of the River Orne. These reports are from the enemy, patently put out as feelers, put out to make possible Allied setbacks later seem more serious than they are. For the record, but to be taken with caution, here is where the enemy says our forces have landed along a 100-mile shoreline. The port of Harfleur, 15 miles east of Cherbourg, and the village 5 miles south of Harfleur. Both sides of the highway from Carentan to Valognes, a section of an important supply road to Cherbourg, running 5 miles inland. An area 27 miles long between Carentan and Bayeux. The estuary of the Orne, and a 15-mile stretch of beaches in the area of Villers and Trouville across the Seine estuary from Le Havre, the town of Honfleur, 6 miles east of Le Havre. Our own reports mention only the city of Caen, named by the Prime Minister, who incidentally will report again to Commons tomorrow on the progress of the invasion. He plans to make a daily affair of it. Another late report that bears out the optimism about the landings: Royal Air Force beach squadrons already have landed in France, taking supplies and plane fuel with them, and a steady stream of RAF planes is now crossing the channel to use landing strips already set up on the beach. These planes are part of the 11,000 in that air armada which covered this landing 24 hours ago. All day and all night they've been crisscrossing the channel with absolutely no opposition. In that air armada were 1,000 troop-carrying aircraft, including gliders, and the Allied High Command said this phase of the invasion was executed with unexpected success. Tonight, the Great Allied Sea Armada is standing off France, too. Enemy reports describe a strong Allied naval force cruising in the Dunkirk-Calais area, opposite Dover and about 200 miles east of Cherbourg. Again, no Allied confirmation of this. The crew of one of that Allied fleet must be having a particularly fine time. The crew of the battleship Nevada, which was repaired and restored to duty after being badly damaged at Pearl Harbor. Some of the same ships which stood behind us at Salerno are in the action, too. The British cruisers Orion and Mauritius, the battleships Warspite, Nelson, and Romilly's, and our own Texas and Arkansas's, in addition to the Nevada. Flagship of the fleet is the cruiser Augusta, in which President Roosevelt used to take vacation trips. And the total Allied Navy losses up to noon Tuesday, 2 destroyers and 1 landing craft. Air losses less than 1%. Nothing from any source has given any indication of when or where the inevitable German counterattack will be launched. Indeed, a report from Berlin via Stockholm quotes a German military spokesman as saying that not even walls of burning oil could stop the waves of Allied attackers which stormed the Atlantic Wall. There is no indication that our forces met any such defenses. This same military spokesman has admitted that at Caen, the Allies are holding a bridgehead 16 and a half miles deep. Here's a Berlin radio report in a broadcast just monitored by NBC, said the German army has as yet made no move to counterattack the invading Allied forces. Most of the German broadcasts tonight have done a complete flip-flop from those earlier in the day when they oozed gloom then, admitted taking a licking and so forth. Evidently, Goebbels didn't go for that so much. These later broadcasts have turned boastful again, bragging about German defenses, and the German high command itself has been very stingy with any definite news. One of the big questions of the day has been, exactly why did the Allied commanders choose the beaches they did, and from London tonight comes the answer. Those beaches had been selected for the initial assault many months ago, but only recently did the Germans start seriously to build up the defenses there. Consequently, the beaches were far less heavily gunned and fortified than the great port areas in Denmark, Holland, Belgium, and France. This chosen stretch remained almost without beach obstacles, and the inshore defenses were nothing like as heavy as those stretching for hundreds of miles on either side. That left a breach of about 60 miles between the northern wing of the defenses keyed around the Elbe and Weser estuaries, the Hook of Holland and the ports of Dunkirk, Calais, Boulogne, Dieppe, and Le Havre, and the southern chain running from Cherbourg through Saint-Malo, Brest, Lorient, and Nantes. Well, that's a lot of geography, but it's the answer to that question, though, of why the Allies went in where they did. Allied reconnaissance for months has showed that the Germans have been making very slow progress in converting this 60-mile breach into a strong point. And then, all of a sudden, they found they were too late. In his prayer tonight, which was so deeply moving, President Roosevelt referred to our soldiers when he said, "They yearn but for the end of battle, for their return to the haven of home. Some will never return." And tonight, from a port in southeast England, comes the story of some of those who will never come home. Minesweepers, the first ships to go out and the first ships to come back, brought back German prisoners from France, also the first American dead from France. A British sailor, his face smutty with coal dust and his dark eyes solemn, stood at attention with fixed bayonet at the head of the gangplank. No one cheered as that first minesweeper edged up to the dock. There was a call for someone from the medical corps, and Captain Thomas Newbold of Brooklyn responded. Standing nearby, Chaplain Meyer Miller of Greenwich, Connecticut, said, "We saw them off, and now we see them back." No one else spoke. The first bill was being presented for the invasion of the West. And just here, the words of President Roosevelt are timely. "Some will never return. Embrace these, Father, and receive them, thy heroic servants, into thy kingdom." On this great day, when the combined efforts of so many are contributing so much to the success of the invasion, it's difficult to single out individual names. But one must be singled out tonight, Signalman Donald Beale of Grand Falls, Idaho. Beale was on watch on the Augusta, the flagship of Admiral Kirk commanding the Western Naval Task Force. The Augusta had been at sea just over 6 hours this morning, leading a column of transport when Beale sang out from the signal bridge, "Mine, dead ahead." The flag bridge quickly relayed the word, and a second after that cry, the rudder had been swung hard to starboard, and the Augusta just missed that big floating mine by 20 yards. Thank the sharp eyes of Signalman Beale for averting a possibly serious accident just at one of the most important moments of the invasion. And now some more personal stories from this invasion, news of how the GIs are doing. Murray Silverfarb of the Bronx has set up a barber shop on the beach. Invasion haircuts are his specialty. Murray had never before run a pair of clippers, but he does a nice, clean job, and the GIs like it. The final mail delivery was made to the invasion troops as they awaited aboard assault boats for the takeoff. One soldier got 50 letters at once. Another got one that came by airmail from New York in only 4 days. Some GIs thought it would be good luck to take German aerial cannon shells with them as talismans, good luck pieces for the invasion. But ordnance teams, checking up on the weight of equipment, took the souvenirs away, as Corporal Clyde Belcher of Greenville, South Carolina, said they'll get plenty where they're going. General Eisenhower seemed to think it would be good luck if he could talk to a paratrooper from his own state of Kansas. And the general's been smoking a lot of cigarettes in the past 24 hours, sometimes lighting one from the stub of another. Somebody asked him if he were nervous. He replied that he's the type that boils up inside, but that when things got too bad, he's usually able to sleep it off. Our NBC monitors heard Radio Brazzaville broadcasting in the highest excitement from the French Congo tonight that General Eisenhower had already set up headquarters in northern France with a staff which included 4 French marshals. Well, that would be nice, but it's a little early for that. the general still operating in an advanced outpost in England. Our monitors also heard a more likely report. The London radio quoting an Allied pilot as saying that he saw the stars and stripes floating over a French town, not named, and finally this report from Germany about the reaction of the German people. United Press correspondent Aldo Forti in Bern reports that when they got the news of the successful Allied landings, they were surprised, bewildered, angered, and dumbfounded. Whether in that order, Forti doesn't say. Now some paragraphs from around the country, what invasion meant to America. In Reno, for instance, the city's two principal businesses were hard hit. The few gambling houses that were open had only a handful of customers, and the divorce courts did even worse. Only 14 petitions were filed. Here in New York, many stores closed to permit employees to join in prayers and celebrations. A crowd of 50,000 persons knelt under the eternal light in Madison Square, and Mayor LaGuardia read the crowd General Eisenhower's order of the day. The Red Cross announced that telephone calls for appointments to donate blood were coming in at three times the usual rate. The New York Daily News printed the Lord's Prayer in the column usually devoted to its editorials. Invasion Day found 14,000 workers still away from their jobs, but thousands of others went back to work in response to pleas to support the fighting forces. Like a gray ghost, the exchange ship Gripsholm tied up at Jersey City today. On board were 51 wounded American soldiers who'd been prisoners of war in Germany. They'd heard the great news at sea. They were in better health already for hearing that news. And John D. Eisenhower had quite a day for his graduation from West Point. The son of the Supreme Commander became a second lieutenant of infantry as his father was launching the greatest military operation of all time. And a movie's on in Denison, Texas tonight, the birthplace of the general, to rename a street for him. One man who might have been expected to know all about the invasion reveals tonight that he heard about it on the radio. Secretary of War Stimson just happened to wake up. Said he was as surprised as anybody else when he tuned in his radio to hear NBC correspondent Wright Bryan of Atlanta telling how he'd just returned from an airplane trip to France where parachute troops were dropped. Reports have been going around in Ankara tonight that there have been Allied landings in the Peloponnesus, and although there's no official confirmation, what are described as responsible quarters in Ankara say tonight that the report could be true now or shortly. The Peloponnesus is that part of Greece south of the Isthmus of Corinth, and when the military experts guess about Allied landings in Greece, that's usually the spot they pick. Latest reports from the Italian front still put American forces 5 miles across the Tiber in pursuit of the disorganized Germans, with Rome piling holiday on holiday. First liberation, now the Western invasion. But today's big story from Rome tells how more than 150 soldiers, mostly Americans, had a surprise audience of Pope Pius today. They'd gathered in front of St. Peter's and asked if they might call in the pontiff. It had been said earlier, and officially, that no soldiers would be permitted inside the Vatican, that no Germans had been, and none of the Allies would be either. But suddenly, that permission came. The group, which included Catholics and Protestants alike, knelt as the Pope blessed them. And he later visited informally with them, talked in English, asked the Americans what part of the country they were from. When two said Washington and New York, the Pope recalled with pleasure his visit here in 1936. The Pope has never received a group of German soldiers in this manner. The American Air Force picked D-Day to stage the first heavy bomber attack from their Russian bases, a new development in the shuttle run against Hitler's Europe, because these heavy bombers returned to their Russian bases instead of going on to Italy or North Africa. The target was Galati, the big German air base in Romania, and the attack was made in direct support of Russian forces staving off German attacks in the Yassi area. We lost no bombers in the attack, but two of the supporting Mustang fighters were shot down, exchanged for 6 German fighters knocked over in aerial combat. The Russian High Command itself selected Galati as the target for this first American raid from Russian bases because a blow there would give the greatest support to Red Army operations on the southern front. Portugal lost no time climbing aboard the United Nations bandwagon as it crashed into Western Europe today. Our State Department announces tonight that Portugal has stopped all shipments of tungsten ore to Germany, and more than that, has halted all production of the war art material so necessary for the manufacture of hard steel. The State Department says the negotiations were concluded on June 5th, significantly the originally scheduled D-Day. Perhaps it's not too much to guess that the Portuguese government was given just the barest kind of a hint as to the Allied power. This is Don Hollenbeck in the NBC newsroom in New York, and that's all for now.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.